From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, after a scathing UN report exposes human rights atrocities in North Korea, we look at what the findings could mean for the regime.
It's important, of course, for the international community to constantly reinforce that individual national leaders can be held accountable for the actions of their regimes.
We look ahead to President Obama's attendance at the North American Leaders Summit in Mexico, with trade and energy set to dominate. And we look at why Volkswagen workers in Tennessee have voted against joining the United Auto Workers Union.
The effort to destroy the union, to defeat the union, threats, there really is no politer way to call it, had an effect on workers.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Clashes have broken out in Ukraine between police and protesters. The first violence to erupt for more than 3 weeks. The trouble started when demonstrators marching to parliament to keep up pressure on President Viktor Yanukovych ran into police lines. Ukraine's opposition want constitutional changes to reduce the powers of the president. Tom Barton has more.
A few thousand protesters threw stones at police and petrol bombs set two trucks ablaze. Police fired rubber bullets, stun grenades and tear gas, firing on protesters from trucks and roofs. Local media report that some protesters have been injured. Inside the parliament, opposition politicians blocked the speaker's tribune and insisted deputies discuss their calls for constitutional changes that would reduce President Viktor Yanukovych's power. Protests started in November when Yanukovych, under heavy Russian pressure, abruptly refused to sign a trade and reform deal with the European Union that had been over 17 years in the making.
Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has expelled three U.S. diplomats after accusing them of siding with anti-government protesters in the country. The U.S. government denied the charges and expressed concern about the rising violence in Venezuela, which so far has taken the lives of three protesters. Andrea Arenas reports.
For several weeks now, tensions have been growing in Venezuela due to deadly clashes between young Venezuelans who are expressing their unhappiness with their country's economy, rising crime rate, and government policies. And government security forces who have fired tear gas and water cannons, so far killing at least three. President Nicolás Maduro's government accused the Obama administration of taking sides and working with the student movement to incite violence. His government announced that the accused U.S. embassy officials had 48 hours to leave the country. The U.S. State Department has denied Venezuela's allegations and has expressed concern about rising violence and about the government's attempts to block peaceful protests.
The Obama administration has decided to resume talks with the Taliban and is proposing a prisoner swap, according to the Washington Post. Officials are seeking to free a U.S. Army soldier in exchange for the release of several detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Here's Daniel Wrenches from Washington.
Bo Bergdahl, an army infantryman, was captured after deciding to walk off base in the Pataka province of eastern Afghanistan in 2009. Recently, videos surfaced which suggest he's still alive. After speaking to several current and former U.S. officials, The Washington Post is reporting that the administration's seeking to revive talks with the Taliban by offering to release five members of the Afghan Taliban at once into protective custody in Qatar.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has made an unexpected stop in Tunisia, en route from Abu Dhabi to Paris, where he is expected to meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Kerry met with Tunisian leaders, where he pledged U.S. support on security issues and the democratic transition. Rebecca Hume has the details.
Tunisia has struggled to keep a strong handle on security since the 2011 Jasmine Revolution, which led to the toppling of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. 2 years on, Tunisia has approved its most progressive constitution yet, but is now battling Islamist militants. In a statement made at the US Embassy in Tunis, Kerry said that no democracy could survive or prosper without security. So far, $24 million of the $400 million of U.S. assistance since the revolution has been spent on training Tunisian security forces. Kerry gave his support to the country's security operations, describing them as well-planned and well-executed.
And two members of the Pussy Riot punk rock band, along with five other activists, were detained in Sochi, the site of the Winter Olympics. The Pussy Riot stars were just freed from a jail sentence in December. They were taken to a police station for questioning and were released a few hours later. The activists said they'll file a complaint over the harsh treatment by police officers who reportedly beat up the detainees. Daria Bendarchuk reports from Russia.
Nadezhda Telakonnikova said on social media that she and Maria Lyokhina, quote, had been detained on suspicion of committing a crime. She stressed that at the time of detention, they were simply walking on the Orzhonikidze street in central Sochi. The two activists found themselves surrounded by police and unidentified representatives of the law enforcement authorities dressed as civilians. Telakonnikova and Lyokhina are reportedly suspected of robbery in a hotel. The Pussy Riot members had earlier posted in social media that they were in Sochi to perform a protest.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. This week, President Barack Obama will meet with his Canadian and Mexican counterparts in Toluca, Mexico, for the annual North American Summit, where the three leaders plan to discuss trade, energy, immigration, crime and other major issues. Hundreds of teachers and activists from all over Mexico plan to march to the summit to protest newly installed Enrique Peña Nieto and his controversial education reform and energy reform policies, which they say would privatise public resources. Many demonstrators also aim to call attention to the impacts and shortcomings of the now 20-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, which they say has led to the exploitation of many documented and undocumented migrant workers. FSN's Alice Olstein has more.
On Tuesday, the eve of the North America Summit, workers and legal advocates in Mexico City accused the governments of both Mexico and the United States of failing to live up to their legal obligations under the North American Agreement on Labor Cooperation, a companion agreement to NAFTA. Jessica Stender, the legal director for the human rights organization Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, describes some of the issues they've documented in the legal immigration programs that were supposed to improve under NAFTA.
There are many abuses that H-2B workers suffer in carnivals and fairs and other work sites, and the abuse starts before they leave Mexico. Even though it's illegal to do so, many companies charge workers recruitment fees, and they don't give them sufficient information about the type of work they'll be doing or working conditions. They also have to pay for their travel to the United States, so nearly all workers arrive deeply in debt. And even though there are abuses of their rights work, they don't see any option to leave because they have the debt to pay.
Groups have submitted petitions documenting grave and systemic labor rights violations under NAFTA since 2003. In this week's supplemental complaint, which demands a ministerial consultation with the two governments, the advocates presented additional examples of companies violating minimum wage laws and overtime laws, providing inadequate training and unsafe work sites, and threatening to blacklist workers who speak out.
The H-2A and H-2B visa programs themselves cause problems and put barriers for workers because a worker can only work for the company that hired him or her. So even if the work conditions are very bad, there are many rights violations. They can't change their jobs. If they leave, they have to return to their country of origin.
With the three North American leaders expected to discuss tweaking NAFTA at this week's summit, as well as greatly expanding free trade under the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, the complaint asks that better legal protections and enforcement mechanisms for migrant workers be included. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
With trade and energy likely to dominate Tuesday's meeting, President Obama may not have much good news for the other two of the so-called three amigos on the Keystone Pipeline or immigration reform. Given that lack of progress, FSN's Lorna Shaddick asked Jeffrey Schott of the Peterson Institute for International Economics just what the summit can really achieve.
The meeting is quite important because it's part of the normal course of business for the three countries of North America. The fact that they meet regularly to have on their agenda that they need to work together for their mutual benefit, I think is extremely important. Whether there are specific deliverables from the meeting is another question, but in this context, I think the immediate action agenda is working together to see how they can close the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, which all three countries are involved in. And if you take the three countries of North America together, they form really the core of the TPP in terms of economic weight. About 60% of the combined output of the TPP countries is accounted for by the three countries. But it's important that for Canada and Mexico, as well as the United States, to have this agreement with major trading nations in Asia.
How effectively do these three leaders work together, and how confident are you that they can work towards those goals effectively?
I think they have a good working relationship. They meet quite frequently in other summits, but this is a particular time when they can focus on the specific North American agenda, what they're doing together to benefit each country, and specific bilateral issues on the agenda. I'm sure in the U.S.-Canada context, energy issues and the Keystone Pipeline will come up. In the U.S.-Mexico context, there are important issues, border issues and immigration issues that hopefully will lend some insights on how each country can work more effectively with each other.
And what then will we see as a concrete outcome?
They'll probably say a lot of nice things, but again, in terms of big deliverables, I think the most important immediate consequence of this summit will be an effective partnership in strategies for closing the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation.
And on immigration, perhaps a little more progress, but still not much that he can point to when it comes to discussions with Mexico.
That could be the big opening, but it takes a lot of political courage. It requires a bipartisan effort. It requires trust among the Democrats and Republicans engaged in that bipartisan effort. And trust between the parties is a rare commodity in Washington these days.
Jeffrey Schott of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. This is FSN Reports. Workers at Volkswagen's plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, have voted against joining the United Auto Workers Union. The workers' decision, a vote of 712 to 626 against the union, was announced late on Friday. The outcome sparked criticism of the tactics used by opponents of unionising staff, in particular the role played by some state Republican leaders. FSN's Malcolm Brown spoke to Richard D. Wolfe, Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, and began by asking him if he was surprised by the outcome.
Well, I thought it would be close the other way, that is, that the United Auto Workers would win this election basically because they've been trying for a long time. The depressed economy is making workers around the country very nervous about their situation and their future. And, of course, the decision by the Volkswagen management in Germany and here in the United States not to do what managements normally do, which is wage a very intense, costly battle against the union. The management decision to remain neutral and to basically say it's okay with them for the workers to vote for a union meant that I thought the preponderance of influence would get the union a victory there.
So given all of those factors, what went wrong from the UAW's perspective?
Well, I asked myself that question as well. The short answer, which I don't think is very profound, is that the effort to destroy the union, to defeat the union, which was led not by the management or the company, which is the normal case, but rather by the Republican Party politicians, leaders in the state of Tennessee, but also nationally, Republican activists like Grover Norquist and others, their mass publicity campaign, their political threats, there really is no politer way to call it, had an effect on workers. But I think the important issue is not that those Republicans did it. The important question is, why was it possible for Republican politicians to have an effect on a struggle that is fundamentally a struggle between a union and a company over the oil representation of those workers. And I think the lesson from Chattanooga is that the larger consciousness of American working people is the issue. That consciousness, which has been worked on very hard over the last 40 years by the business community and conservatives, has not been worked on by the other side of the political equation, and you saw here the result.
If the unions can't win this one, I guess the argument might go, which one can they win? This was potentially fertile ground, wasn't it, given the company's position?
For me, the lesson is clear. Your problem as a union is you've got to deal with the vulnerability of the mass of the people you're trying to reach to a set of ideas and notions and concepts that militate against you, and that you have to confront in the media, you have to confront in the schools, you have to confront in the day-to-day life of people, or else you're going to disappear as a movement, especially when you lose an election like this one, where the normal obstacles were so much reduced.
Richard D. Wolfe talking to FSN's Malcolm Brown. A wide array of crimes against humanity have been and continue to be committed in North Korea. The scathing findings of a UN report into what it described as the country's unspeakable atrocities. The report went as far as to recommend the regime's leader, Kim Jong-un, be tried at the International Criminal Court. The findings from the UN Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea examined satellite imagery, evidence and testimonies from more than 100 victims, witnesses and experts. Earlier, I discussed what impact this report could have on the North Korean regime with Professor of Political Science, Stephen Weber, from the University of California, Berkeley.
Well, I'm not actually sure that it's caused a great deal of controversy in terms of its findings. I think the extent and the type of human rights abuses that have been happening in North Korea for decades have been well known to people who study the country and are able to access what little information leaks out about it. The evidentiary basis for the report is mainly based on refugees and others who have left the country, and so they're going to paint the worst possible picture. But again, I don't think anyone was terribly surprised by the content of the report. I think some may have been surprised by the language that the UN uses. It's quite strong language, but certainly not unprecedented.
How do you think the contents of this report will influence U.S. policy towards North Korea?
Well, let me take a step back and say it's important, of course, for the international community, in this case represented by the United Nations, to constantly reinforce the message that individual national leaders can, in some sense, be held accountable for the actions of their regimes. Having said that, I think this will influence the United States policy not at all. The U.S. policy toward North Korea is being driven by larger issues, at least in Washington's view, than a report which illustrates or demonstrates what everyone in Washington already knows about the human rights situation. I think the human rights situation in and of itself is seen as a secondary issue, that the way to deal with the human rights situation is to deal with the larger issues concerning the North Korean regime. It does put some pressure on government authorities, both in Washington and elsewhere, to speak out on the issue, but I don't know that it's going to change anyone's policy dramatically.
Someone who actually came to the defense of the North Korea regime was China, dismissing this report. But then China itself is never too keen when the international community highlights its own human rights abuses.
Well, I think, you know, the Chinese, of course, are always sensitive to the United Nations speaking out about human rights abuses in any part of the world, largely because they're concerned about their sort of core concern, issues of sovereignty, and we've seen that before. I actually think that there's a somewhat less insidious interpretation of the Chinese reaction as well. The Chinese are very pragmatic with regard to North Korea, and they're first and foremost interested in what the North Korean regime does and how much trouble it does or does not cause on the international scene. So there are cooler heads in Beijing who are probably asking the question, look, does this report make dealing with North Korea easier or harder? And the answer is it just feels to them probably like it inflames the situation. They would very much prefer to deal with the North Koreans sort of under the table and try to get gradual motion that way. They don't like the thing being on the front pages of the newspapers.
And one aspect of the report was a recommendation that the 31-year-old current leader in North Korea, Kim Jong-un, actually face the ICC, the International Criminal Court, over these atrocities and human rights abuses. What's the likelihood of that ever coming about? And does that bring us back to what's the actual impact of a report like this?
Yeah, so there's sort of two parts to that issue. One is... Again, the sort of general message that national leaders can be held accountable. In practice, the ICC operates at the behest of the UN Security Council, and although the Chinese have not explicitly said they would veto any such move in the Security Council, it's almost certain that they will. Look, it's not inconceivable that one day the leader of North Korea, whether it be Kim Jong-un or his successor, might face the ICC over a set of issues. But if that happens, it won't be because of anything this report did. It will be because the regime collapsed and he was deported or captured or something else. So although, again, this is an important statement, in and of itself, it probably has very little impact on how things are going to eventually play out in North Korea.
Professor Stephen Weber. Now, a senior British court has ruled that judges in England and Wales do have the right to send prisoners who have committed extremely serious offences to spend the rest of their lives in jail without the hope of parole or review. The ruling runs counter to one issued by the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg last year. The court sided with three convicted murderers given whole life tariffs that this amounted to inhumane and degrading treatment. Our reporter Catherine Drew in London explains the background to the case.
Well, this morning we heard, after a five-judge panel had considered this, we heard that they have upheld the whole life tariff. In other words, prisoners are able to be sentenced to prison for the rest of their lives. Now, this case had come about because in July of last year, the European Court of Human Rights had ruled that whole life tariffs were a breach of human rights. The court said that to never have the possibility of parole was inhuman and degrading, and that prisoners did need the possibility of release or at least a review of their sentences. Now, that case had originated at the European Court of Human Rights after three convicted murderers had taken the British government their case against the British government all the way to the European Court of Human Rights. But today we did hear from the Court of Appeal, and Lord Chief Justice Lord Thomas had this to say about the ruling.
The court has held that the statutory scheme enacted by Parliament, which enables judges to pass whole life orders, is entirely compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. Judges should therefore continue, as they have done, to impose whole life orders in those rare and exceptional cases which fall within the statutory scheme.
The panel of judges said that the court in Strasbourg was wrong when it said that whole life prison terms could not ever be reduced, because here prisoners do have the ability to appeal to the Secretary of State. So on that point, the court here in London said that the Strasbourg court was incorrect.
Catherine, can you explain to us, has there been a government reaction on the whole life prison issue?
Well, the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, speaking for the government, has welcomed the decision.
I am pleased that the Court of Appeal has taken the decision that these sentences, which are used very sparingly, are proper ones in these particular cases. That will provide the public with reassurance, and also, in fact, that they are wholly in conformity with the European Convention on Human Rights.
Currently in England and Wales, 53 people are serving whole life sentences. Now, these include the serial killer Rosemary West, Peter Sutcliffe, the so-called Yorkshire Ripper, and also Moore's murderer Ian Brady, who tortured and murdered five children in the mid-60s. So these are extremely serious cases, and the government was at pains to reiterate that these whole life tariffs are only applied to those really, really extreme cases.
There's also the current sentencing case for the killers of British soldier Lee Rigby.
Yes, back in December, Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowole, they were convicted of the murder of Fusilier Lee Rigby. Now, he is the soldier who was run over in the street last summer in a London street near his barracks. And then they attacked him and dragged his body into the road and hacked at his body. Obviously, he died of his injuries. Now, they were both convicted back in December, but the judge held off on the sentences because he wanted to hear the ruling from the Court of Appeal. So now when a date is set, they will be sentenced, and I think we can imagine there is a possibility that both of those will receive whole life tariffs.
Our reporter Catherine Drew in London. 6,000 miles from an Amsterdam attic and 70 years from the darkest hours of World War II, a sapling from a tree that gave Anne Frank hope as she hid from the Nazis has taken root in a Holocaust and genocide memorial grove at Sonoma State University in Northern California. Rachel Silverman visited the grove and has this report.
It's a 5-foot sapling, an offshoot taken from the towering horse chestnut tree that Anne Frank could see from her annex window.
She watched it bloom and then lose its leaves and then bloom again for a number of years while she was hidden.
Sonoma State University Dean Emerita Elaine Leader explains what the tree meant to Anne Frank.
It was one of the few pieces of nature that she was able to see from her perch. And so it became a sign for her that life continues, life germinates and goes on and on.
That tree died after an ice storm in 2010, but the Anne Frank Center USA arranged for 11 offshoots to be planted in the United States, and Leader was instrumental in arranging for one of them to come to Sonoma State. Landscape gardener Jim Silva has been nursing the sapling since it arrived 4 years ago.
It's already pushing buds. And in a few weeks, if the weather stays the way it is, the buds will crack open and it will start to leaf out again. And in the springtime, it'll have all new shiny leaves and it'll start to grow.
The tree and the grove in which it grows hold special meaning for Hans Angress, a Holocaust survivor who was a classmate of Anne Frank's. Hans' older brother and Anne's sister received notice at the same time, July 1942, that the Nazis were sending them to Germany.
That's when the deportation started, and kids in my class continued to disappear. Now, some were picked up and deported, and others went into hiding. Of my class of 23, actually 12 survived. Of Anne Frank's class of 33, 11 survived.
Angra says he and Anne Frank took physical education class together, and he remembers her as a girl who was not afraid to speak her mind.
Her luck ran out and my health. I mean, in order to survive, you needed a lot of things, but you also needed luck.
The Frank family was eventually betrayed, and everyone but Anne's father died in German concentration camps. Her diary about their life in hiding remains a beloved account of an ordinary girl's experience of a terrible time. In it, she wrote, "I look up at the blue sky and the bare chestnut tree on whose branches little raindrops shine, appearing like silver, and at the seagulls and other birds as they glide on the wind. As long as this exists, I thought, and I may live to see it, this sunshine, the cloudless skies, while this lasts, I cannot be unhappy." The tree is expected to grow to 80 feet tall and live for 150 years, a symbol for many generations to come that the past should not be forgotten. Rachel Silverman in Rohnert Park, California.
And that's Tuesday's edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com, and you can interact with us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. And coming up on Wednesday, all the details from the American Leaders Summit in Toluca, Mexico. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.